So, I mean, this description was for a point particle in 1D, yeah, so just one degree of freedom. So how do we generalize this to n dimensions? Well, this is completely straightforward. Yeah? So if we have 1D going to n dimensions, so the only thing that we need to do is to consider this configuration variable q here, yeah, the generalized coordinates, to be a vector, yeah, to encompass not only one direction but n directions. So we want to replace q, or we just want to interpret it as a vector, which can still call it q, which has n components. So for example, if you have m particles in three dimensions, then the n would be equal to 3m. So, and in the same way, I mean, I haven't said this explicitly, but I guess you remember this, that the dot conventionally just refers to the time derivative. And this definition stays. Yeah? So the q dot is still the total time derivative of the q, now in a vector notation. So the only thing that changes then, the same argument runs through here, yeah? So we want to minimize the action. We get the same equation of motions, just that now it is a vector equation. Yeah? So the q here is really a vector that appears. So if you want, you can write this as in terms of components. Yeah? Then you get n coupled second order differential equations. Yeah? So that means you need to provide 2n initial conditions for the q, for all the qi's, and the velocities qi dot. So this is really straightforward, but we saw that we really, what we want to do is to describe not a theory with n degrees of freedom, even if n is very large, but a theory with infinitely many degrees of freedom. Yeah, so, and this is what makes or defines a field theory. So let's try to understand what is the decisive step that we have to take here. Yeah, so essentially, then, if we take the continuum limit, rather than describing or using a Lagrange function, yeah, that describes or encompasses all the physics of n degrees of freedom, we need a Lagrangian density. So we consider a Lagrangian density in the atom. So why is it that we want to just consider a Lagrangian density? So in other words, a Lagrange function that is defined at each point in space-time. Yeah, so in this sense, a density, it's really a density with respect to space, or more general space-time. Well, this is essentially a requirement that comes from locality. So if we want to construct a general theory that contains infinitely many degrees of freedom, but still maintains the requirement of locality, we cannot allow for instantaneous interactions at a distance. Yeah, so we cannot have, for example, terms in the Lagrangian or the Lagrangian density in the action, but connect somehow physics that happens at one space-time point with another space-time point. Yeah, because there's a finite time it will take for light or any information to travel between the two. So this cannot be allowed. So all the functions, all the information that is in the action, in the Lagrangian, must be with respect to a single space-time point. This is why we need to consider a Lagrangian density. So in other words, we write our action, yeah, as, well, we can still write it as a time integral of a Lagrange function, but because we're led to consider a density, this naturally generalizes to treating space and time on equal footings, such that we have a space-time integral, yeah, d4x, of a density. So now the density is with respect to time, with respect to space, because this was already, and we need to integrate this function in order to get a dimensionless function, namely the action. And in order to rewrite this as a space-time integral, we basically just considering units. Now we need to divide this by volume factor. So not sensitive, it's a density. So we have a Lagrange density, and the Lagrange density depends on space-time functions. Yeah, so let's call them phi. So this is a function of x. Okay, let's maybe not indicate this, not to make the kind of notation even more confusing. And well, I mean, here we had a time derivative. Yeah, so here we had a time derivative, but if we want to treat, because we want to construct relativistic theory, a relativistic invariant theory, we should treat space and time on equal footings. So we should allow all space-time derivatives. Yeah, so rather than just allowing a dependence on the time derivative, we allow dependences on the derivatives with respect to all space-time directions. Yeah, so this then we call the Lagrangian density, or in fact just the Lagrangian. And this here, the space-time function, well, this is our field. Yeah, so this is what we mean by a field. A field is just a space-time function. It's a function that can take on different values at each point in space-time. So it has a general dependence on the space-time coordinates. And this is what we call a field. So a field theory then is the theory for these space-time functions. So we want to derive equations of motions for these space-time functions in the very same way as we want to describe or derive equations of motion for the positions and velocities of individual point particles. So that means that if you compare the two approaches here, you should really think of these fields as the corresponding thing to generalized coordinates. Yeah, so it's no longer the x mu here, that is the phase space variable, but the phi itself. So the phi at each space-time point corresponds to what we previously called qi. Yeah, and that is also how you see how this naturally implements the idea of the continuum limit, an infinite number of degrees of freedom. So the I, in other words, so this one here, the index, is really the same as the x mu. Yeah, so instead of an I could also write x mu as an index here. And of course, there's infinitely many space-time points. So in that sense, we've implemented a theory with infinitely many degrees of freedom. Yeah, so the degrees of freedom, just to say that yet in other words, that we have describe the possible field values at each point in space-time. Yeah, so think, for example, of the temperature in this room. It can take on like a different value at each point in space, but it can also vary in time. So at each point in space-time, you can assign a different temperature. And then a theory like this would describe how the temperature in the room evolves. Yeah, so how do we get to this these equations that describe the evolution? So we would still call them equations of motions. Well, of course, we should always try to, I mean, start with principles that we know that work and see whether they work also in this case. So we should still, at least as the first approach, resort to this least action principle. And we will see that this is indeed what describes field theories just as well as classical particles. So if we use this, let's just do this explicitly, also to fresh up your memory of this step here. Yeah, so you did that in classical mechanics, but maybe rush through this or don't remember it. And it follows essentially the same ideas. So let's do it explicitly. So we use the principle of least action. Yeah, so just concretely apply this. So we require that the variation vanishes. So this is the principle of least action. And now, in order to actually apply this principle, we need to, well, vary this action explicitly. So we can, you just use the definition, the action is the integral of the Lagrangian, and varying the Lagrangian means that we can, well, how can we vary it? We vary it with respect to the fields. Now we want to know how the fields evolve, so we vary the Lagrangian with respect to the field. So we can do this by varying either the field values or the derivatives in each action. So basically, the variation of this one, we can evaluate by using the, viewing this as a total infinitesimal change in L. Yeah, so we should just use the basic rules of total derivatives and converting this to partial derivatives. So that means that we can write it as follows. So I have the variation of the Lagrangian with respect to the field times the variation of the field plus, and then I can have the variation of the Lagrangian with respect to derivatives in the field times the variation with respect to these derivatives. Okay, so in this notation here, I can view, I mean, I can just pick the value for mu. For example, mu equal to naught would be the time derivative, and then this is the variation with respect to the time derivative. So it would be just, would say basically dl d phi dot, and there would be a phi dot here. But of course, this notation here means that I should consider all the derivatives. So it's actually the Lagrangian depends on five independent functions, phi, dt phi, dx phi, dy phi, dz phi, for example, in Euclidean coordinates. But this way of writing here is a convenient way because, I mean, you should remember the summation convention here. So we have repeated indices. So these are summed over. So these are actually four terms. So let me just write this explicitly. That we already used the sum convention here. Okay, so then let's continue to manipulate these terms. So the first thing to note is that a variation in a derivative, remember that a derivative is just an infinitesimal change. So now we're talking about an infinitesimal change of an infinitesimal change. So essentially, we have two derivatives here. And you know that partial derivatives just commute. So I can rewrite this as the derivative of the variation in the field. Okay, and then the next step is that I can do a little trick. I can look at this term and see that there's a derivative, and well, it's a derivative with respect to mu, all four space-time dimensions. We have a four-dimensional integral, and in these situations, it's also always or typically useful to consider an integration by parts. So let's do that. So d4x, the first term doesn't change. So d phi, then we should consider doing the integration by parts. We have the derivative acting on the full expression. So there's a partial derivative missing here. Remember, I was taking the derivative of L with respect to d mu phi. Del d mu phi times this term, so times delta phi. And then I should subtract the mistake that I do. So, because if I apply the partial derivative on this term, I get, well, from the summation rule, I get one term acting on this, Yeah, this is not what is here, and one term acting on this. This is what I already have. So I should subtract the wrong term. So minus just a delta phi du acting on only the derivative. Delta phi. Okay, so why is this useful? Well, it's useful because we see now that we have a total derivative here. So now you can think of the 3D corresponding expression. Yeah, then you know that if you have a volume integral and a total derivative, so divergence of something, then you can use Stokes' theorem to rewrite this into a surface integral. Yeah, this is a four-dimensional volume integral, so the 3D analog would just be a standard volume integral. And Stokes' theorem works just as well in n dimensions. So here we can rewrite this, I mean, including the integral. So if this is an integral over some volume of space-time, then we can rewrite this as an integral over the surface of this volume. And then we have a 3D integral. Now let's call the volume element on the surface sigma nu. Yeah, so it has an index because the surface is always oriented. So a surface always points in a direction. So the vector is the normal vector to the surface. And the length of the vector is what you would associate to the area of the surface. So the area is, of course, I mean, it's a three-dimensional surface here. So the area is what you typically would call a volume. In terms of Stokes' theorem, we should refer to this as a surface. A surface in 4D, but it's a volume in 3D. Okay, and it's a surface volume of just the term in parentheses here. So let's write that. We don't even need the parentheses. So we have dl d phi and delta phi. Now, so this is a term, in other words, that is directly proportional to the variation of the field value. And since we're integrating over the surface of the space-time, it is only affected, this whole term is only affected by variations of the field value, so by possible changes in the field value at the surface of the space-time region that we consider. And such total divergences or surface terms are typically set to zero. So the general intuitive argument is that basically, I mean, we haven't defined the volume that we're talking about. So typically you would perform a local experiment. And for sure, the local experiment that you're performing should not depend on the space-time region of the much larger region that you could consider. Yeah, so in particular, if you perform a tabletop experiment, it should certainly not depend on the boundary conditions that you impose at the edge of the universe. So mathematically, we can formulate. So, okay, let's just write this down. So this is typically just set to zero. Yeah, in our context, in particle physics, you should be a bit careful because it's not always set to zero. Yeah. So for example, in condensed matter physics, surface terms do matter. Yeah. You have to think about if you, for example, describe a crystal. Yeah. So excitations on a crystal can also be in a very nice way. Well, it's the typical way to describe it by quantum field theories, actually, because you have so many degrees of freedom. But then you should worry about these surface terms. Yeah. In our case, we describe really local interactions where we can't identify these surfaces. So we can always neglect this. So mathematically, let's just state this, what actually enters in this assumption. Yeah, so there are two things that enter. So one is something that is always satisfied, also in the condensed matter case. So we should require that variations in the field value. So remember that the field is a space-time function. Yeah, so explicitly I can write it as a function of t and x. So if I write it as, let's say, the initial time t1 and any field configuration in space that we can have, this should vanish just as the variation at the final time. So why is that? Well, this is basically our setup. You know, so we want to describe, in this analogy, we want to describe how a particle evolves from Q1 to Q2. So at an initial time T1 to a final time T2. So now instead we want to describe how a given field configuration at a given time T1 evolves into another field configuration at a time T2. So take our example of the temperature gradient in the room. Yeah, we have some value that we measure at a given initial time T1. And then we want our theory to describe or predict how will the temperature distribution look like at another time T2. So in order to describe this variation, of course, I mean, as also indicated in this figure, we don't vary the initial and final conditions. You know, this is the very question that we are asking, like given a fixed defined initial point and final point, what is the trajectory between the two? Okay, but the other thing that enters is what I said in words here. And that is that we want to make sure that the variation basically falls off sufficiently fast for any times in between. So if we have any times in between this evolution, yeah, we want to make sure that this falls off to zero sufficiently fast. As you go to radial infinity. Yeah? So as you go away from the experiment that you're performing, you want to make sure that it falls off. Yeah? So you can also, just looking mathematically at this expression, quantify what it means. Yeah? You have a volume integral. So this is a 3D space integral. So in order for this integral then not to contribute anything at infinity, you basically must make sure that this one here falls off slightly faster than 1 to absolute value of x to the 3 cubed. And this is, in words, essentially what I said before, that we want to make sure that physics is local, so it's not affected by boundary conditions far, far away. Yeah, and this is also exactly the statement that is not necessarily satisfied if you describe a crystal, for example, because then you can have very concrete but physical effects from the boundary. You can have physics affecting on the boundary, affecting the measurements and the time evolution inside the crystal. Okay, so let's go back to what we started off to describe. Yeah, we wanted to see what is the effect of this variation. We just understood that for the whole purpose of this course, we can always neglect these kind of terms, total divergences, because we can transform them into surface integrals that vanish at the boundaries. So what is left then is just this term and this term, and we integrate over it, and it should vary, give zero. Now, so let's just briefly rewrite this. So we have 0 equal to d4x, and then we have a dl d phi minus d mu dl d mu phi times the variation in phi. Yeah. So now basically the requirement is that this integral here vanishes, but it should vanish for any possible variation of the phi, of the field phi. Yeah. So it vanishes for all possible delta phi of x mu. Yeah, subject to these constraints. So it's not quite all possible. Yeah, the variation should satisfy these two constraints. But apart from that, they can take all possible, you can consider all possible variations, and the whole integral should still vanish. Now, this is only possible if the port inside the parentheses vanishes identically. So this must be zero. And these are exactly our equations of motion for the field. So minus dl phi equal to zero. And of course, it looks very similar to the equations of motion that we've seen for the point particle. And it's indeed just exactly the same. It's just the infinite dimensional version of this. Yeah, so these are the Euler-Lagrange equations. So, and in the same sense as before, these describe equations of motions. So, equations of motion for the field phi x mu. So, for a spacetime, for some arbitrary spacetime function. So, also purely mathematically, it means that it's again a second order differential equation. So you should specify the field value at all positions in space at a given initial time t. And you also need to specify the derivative, the time derivative, and gradients at an initial time. And then the solution is uniquely defined. So you can predict in a unique way, it's a deterministic evolution, how the field will evolve. So let me just mention one more thing. Just as it was straightforward to go from 1D to ND in the particle case, it's also straightforward to consider multiple fields. So straightforward to describe multiple fields. So basically, we just provide this phi, but this was just a single degree of freedom at each space-time point, with an index. Yeah, so we can just give it an index a and not to confuse with space-time indices. Yeah, so then we can have, for example, two scalar fields. We can have, the density and the temperature inside a room. Yeah, then A would range from 1 to 2. Yeah, we could describe vector fields like the electromagnetic field. Yeah, then we have at each point in space and time, we have a vector, namely the electromagnetic field vector pointing in some direction. Yeah, so then this A would run from 1 to 3. We could have two vector fields, electric and magnetic fields, then the A would run from 1 to 6. We could have completely different fields, and we will always have exactly the same equation of motion, just that then we have, depending on how many field components we have n coupled partial differential equations of this type. Yeah, but it's the general concept doesn't change. This is the basic basis of field theory in a nutshell, if you wish. And these describe the equations of motion. So the fundamental object that we need to describe and fully define a field theory is this Lagrangian or Lagrangian density.